Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of Alana Golan, Leap Academy. In this episode, Mo Gaudet, a former chief business officer at Google X, shares his transformative journey following a profound personal loss. He emphasizes that happiness is a choice and explores how to manage stress effectively, shifting from a corporate mindset to one focused on happiness. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website, podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
You're born happy. Happiness is 100% a choice.
Mo Gaudet, former chief business officer in Google X. Mo made a major leap after an unthinkable personal loss. He is now a 4X best-selling author, podcaster, has huge mission to make people happier and unstressable.
I was the happiest person ever until the death of my wonderful son, Ali. The surgeon does 5 mistakes in a row. Every one of them was preventable. I felt a physical part of my heart disappear. Suddenly, life is put in perspective. My capitalist hat turns from I want to finish my life a billionaire to I want to finish my life a billionaire of happiness. And there I am. I'm no longer a corporate executive. I no longer have stocks falling into my bank account every week, and I've never been happier. It's not the events of your life that stress you. It's the way you deal with them that does. We say there are 4 quadrants of stress. We call them.
I can't wait to talk to you. Mo, thank you for joining me here.
Thank you so much. It's an honor. You're setting me up now for people to expect quite a bit. I don't have that much, probably. But let's give it a try. Thank you for having me.
Yes, you do. Yeah. Oh, my God. But you need to take us back in time. Like, I mean, when I listen, chief business officer of one of the biggest, coolest projects on the planet, and then on the other hand, you grew up in Egypt, you don't have all the connections. So take us back in time. You didn't even go to tech right away. You loved engineering, but you didn't even go to tech right away. Take us a little bit back in time to Egypt.
Yeah, it is actually quite an odd story, if you ask me. I mean, I always say that when I was hired as the chief business officer of Google X, there would have probably been at least 10,000 Americans that were more fit for that job than I am, right? That knew the market better, lived in California already, understood Silicon Valley better. My wonderful daughter normally tells me that I was paid in advance, which is probably the core of my story. But let's go back to the beginning. As you said, I was born and raised in Egypt, public school, public university in Egypt. My mom was an academic who loved reading and learning. She taught English, so she taught me badly, as you can see with my weird accent. And then and my dad was a math geek and a very serious engineer. Interestingly, in our family, my mom was more the order and discipline. My dad was the heart. Even though you can see the interesting mix, because he was a real geek, right? But somehow that mix. I was born a little bit on the spectrum, which was not diagnosed, but became very clear when I became older and had conversations with my mom about what it was like when I was a child, where I completely understood mathematics way better than I understood English or Arabic at the time. And in my hometown in Cairo, that's not what kids want you to do to be able to be friends. So, you know, they wanted me to play soccer and basically, you know, just talk about silly stuff. And it was quite complex for me because I would hide to read my physics books. And I thought of myself as something is wrong with me. And in a way, as I say, it's probably my diversity that made me not worry that much about them and continue to sort of invest in what I loved in the background. And I married a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful human being. She's no longer my wife, but she completely impacted my life when I graduated. She was not very comfortable living in Egypt. And so she was the one that urged me to start exploring the world a little more.
And so you want to marry your wife, but somehow that gets you into tech. And I want to understand, no, like, what happened?
What got me into tech is very early, actually. I started coding on a Sinclair. Mm-hmm. You don't even probably, you were born like 20 years later, right? And I, you know, I coded on a Sinclair, a Commodore, you know, and then of course on an IBM compatible at the time. That's what we called it. And what really flipped my life upside down, believe it or not, is my parents wanted to renovate the home, our apartment, and my two elder brothers were teenagers at the time. I was probably 9 or something. And my parents basically said, someone has to be at home to open the door for the workers and just make sure that their needs are met. Can you stay at home for 2 months in summer? I was like, I am a teenager. You know, I wasn't a teenager, but I'm a child, and I, you know, it's my summer vacation. At least you should buy me an IBM compatible PC so that I can actually learn to code. And so that was the deal I cut with my dad. You know, I traded 2 months of my life for an IBM compatible. And by the end of the 2 months, I remember vividly, I wrote a code that basically took musical notes and turned them into musical sheets for my guitar playing, because at the time you couldn't actually get tabs and so on. You had to buy books for that. And I became a very serious developer just with those 2 months, because basically I'd wake up in the morning and I have 8 hours of nothing but reading the manuals. And it improved my English. It improved my understanding of, you know, logic and algorithms and so on.
Amazing.
And so that was really, really an interesting turning point. And another turning point, of course, is I loved my dad so much, and my mom, of course. But my dad was a distinguished engineer. He was probably one of the top civil engineers in his generation in Egypt, because he was responsible for the road and traffic system, where Egypt really suffered for quite a bit of time. And then he, through convincing his company and the government and so on, created a massive network that really helped a lot of people. And so my elder brothers both did not choose civil engineering. And my dad sort of came to me when it was time to apply for universities. And he said, would you be a civil engineer for me? Like, at least one of my kids should follow my trail. And I was like, yeah, no problem. That's not a problem. And I basically became a civil engineer because he wanted me to. But I was a horrendous geek. Like, I basically just, you know, finished whatever my uni wanted me to do in half an hour a day, and then spent the rest of the day in front of a computer. And so basically when I graduated, I'm a bit weird because I was a very, very, very good developer at the time. But then I graduated and I decided I wanted to be a carpenter. And again, because of my parents, at a point in time, I said, I want to become a carpenter. And so they bought me all the books, all the tools. They took a bit of our little apartment, turned it into a small workshop, and put up with all of the sawdust and all of the mess that I did. But I became a really, 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 I love it so much until today. I still build projects almost every week. So I basically didn't understand money or capitalism or success or anything, other than I understood I wanted to marry Nibel, my first wife, which we were together 6 years by then. And she was like, it's time. And so in my culture at the time, you'd had to propose to her father. And of course, her father wouldn't give her to me if I was a carpenter. So I needed to find a job, right? Remember, I finished as a civil engineer, but my graduation project, they gave us a very complex road network. And instead of doing it the way they did, I wrote code, basically. which solved the entire network in like literally for the first 2 weeks. I'm providing nothing, not submitting any of the drawings, and my supervisor was like, "You're gonna fail." I was like, "Just give me a couple of weeks," and then poof, I went in with this much of. At the time, we had dot matrix printers, so an entire report of every little elevation in every bit of the road. And before I even started drawing, I started to get job offers to be a civil engineer in the top companies in the country.
Wow.
And I said, no, I want to be a carpenter. Until one day, I don't know if this is interesting or if we're chit-chatting, just because people need to know that a lot of life is luck when you really, really think about it. Now I need to marry Nibel. I need to find a good job, but I'm a freaking carpenter. I love what I do. And one day I have a fender bender with a friend of mine. So I hit him in a traffic light. So he's opening his door, coming out, sort of ready to shout at me. And he goes like, "Oh my God, Mo, how have you been?"
After reflecting on the unexpected twists of a carpenter's journey and the role of luck in life, the conversation shifts to a remarkable career transition as the focus turns to the responsibilities of a vice president at Google.
I was just leaving my position as vice president of emerging markets, which probably is the biggest privilege ever for anyone to. So I was responsible for the next 4 billion users of Google, which wasn't really, it wasn't really opening a sales office. It was really making Google understand the market and establishing the internet and the democracy of information and e-commerce. And it really was an incredible privilege, right? And I was just moving, to Google X it's now 4 years later after I decided to write that book and I didn't write it. And then life kicks me in the balls, basically.
So let's talk about that. And I assume you're talking about 2014.
Yeah, 2014. I was at Google X at the time, chief business officer. And, again, every 2.5-3 weeks, I get a nagging feeling inside saying, write it. This is a good book. Write it. And I never wrote before, and English is not my native language. And at the time, Ali Habibi was, he was in Northeastern at the time, and he played in a band, and they got a gig to open for a famous rock band in summer.
Wow.
And so we didn't expect to see him in summer. Aya was in Montreal studying in Concordia. And anyway, I get this call from Ali, and Ali and I are men. So we talk once every 2 weeks or whatever. And hey, babe, are you good? Yeah. All right. That's it. Right. And anyway, I get this strange call. Ali rarely ever calls, and he goes, "Papa, I feel compelled." I'm quoting, this is his exact words. "I feel compelled to come and see you before the tour. Is it okay if I buy a ticket?" Ali was that polite. We're multimillionaires at the time. And he would always go like, "Is it okay with you if I spend this extra $5, right? And I say, "Oh my God, Habibi, yes, please. That would be so wonderful. I'll take a couple of weeks off." I called Aya. I said, "Aya, why don't you come over as well? The family together again." And now I'm the happiest. I love those kids. I really do. And anyway, Ali arrives 3 days later. He's not himself. He's saying things that are really worrying, right? I mean, I vividly remember he wanted to change his major to game design, video game design, which meant that he would have to change university and city, right? He told his mom. I said, "Yeah, absolutely, but I was busy at the time. I'll talk to him when he comes to Dubai." So I go. For the first 3 days, I keep telling him, "Ali, shall we talk about this just so that we get it out of the way?" And he goes like, "No, it's okay, Papa." And then, again, "No, it's okay, Papa." And then the last time I asked him, the night before he left us, I said, "Ali, shouldn't we talk about this?" And he said, again, I quote, he said, "Papa, it's okay. I'm not going to make it." Okay. Anyway, the next morning he wakes up with a very severe belly ache. And, they say they know So good people know that when they're leaving. And Ali knew in so many ways, oh my God, that the day before Habibi took us, it's probably the most touching moment of my life. We went out for lunch 2 days before. And Ali, as I said, he didn't speak much. He just, you know, always either joked or said something wise. So we're out there, we're having lunch together, the four of us. And then he says, I have something to say. We go like, yes, Ali has something to say, right? And he speaks for 45 minutes nonstop, right? He looks at each of us in the eyes and he says, you really know I love you, right? Like a dying grandfather. He says, you know, this is what I really love about you. This is what you taught me when I was this. And he just recites the whole thing, each of us for like 10, 15 minutes. And then he says, but there are a couple of things I'd like you to do to I think it would make you perfect, right? On the 1st of July, he gets this belly pain. We take him to a hospital. He's diagnosed with an appendix inflammation, not even severe. They prescribe an appendectomy, which is the simplest surgery known to humankind. And the surgeon does 5 mistakes in a row. Ali gets into the operating room at 10 p.m. At 4 a.m., we lose him. 5 mistakes in a row. Every one of them was preventable. Every one of them was fixable. They fixed them wrong. And yeah, and then suddenly life is put in perspective. So suddenly you recognize so many things. You know, there is an inevitability to loss that completely beats your ego out of you.
Well, it's a loss of a son. Like, there's nothing.
Yeah, and at his absolute prime, and a loving child, and the pride of a father. I mean, that moment when I hugged him before he went into the operating room, Ali was tall, handsome, very wise, very smart, but also very loving. He had this incredible hug. And when he was maybe 15, so he was a shorter child than normal. So being an annoying father that I am, I used to call him Shorty. And, jokingly, not all the time, but like, hey, come here, Shorty. Do you want to, should I, whatever, play, whatever. And he would laugh about it. And then when he was 15, I traveled a lot, but sometimes 2-3 weeks at a time. And then, I come back and he's taller than me. And so I'm like, Ali, are you taller than me? And he goes like, he answers and says, yes, fat hobbit. And from then, onwards, I don't get to call him Shorty anymore. And he gets to call me fat hobbit. And I hug him before he goes into the operating room. And he goes like, it's going to be fine, fat hobbit. And then he sits on the operating table, right? And he had a tattoo on his back that he had and never told me that he had. He told his mom, again, because of how Ali is. He basically said, I'm so upset because I didn't ask Papa if I can use his money to get that tattoo.
Aww.
Yeah, but then I'm going to tell him one day, but I'm not ready, right? Anyway, so I see it for the first time because it's appearing from his scrubs from the back.
Right.
It says, the very last sentence that Ali tells me, the gravity of the battle means nothing to those at peace. That's what the tattoo says. And so I cry when I see it because I saw it without his will. And I go like, I approve, Habibi. It's absolutely fine. It's a lovely tattoo. But then it's the last message he gives me. Right. And I, 10 hours later, he's gone. And suddenly everything's put in perspective. The interesting thing is, so you're blurry, right? You just you're that executive that's been paid all his life to solve problems. This one is not solvable. So you're struggling with it. You're trying to, keep your wife and daughter okay. You know, it's losing a child is just doesn't feel right.
Okay. Oh, it's eating alive. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
I still have the same pain, but less severe. So I felt a physical part of my heart disappear. So the bottom right hand side, and I still feel it. Not ever fully healed. Anyway, 4 days later, Aya walks into my study and basically says, "Papa, Ali had a dream, and he only told me about it, and I think you should know it." And I go like, "Yes." 2 weeks before he died, he had a dream. He said, he calls her, so they were very close. He calls her and says, "Hey, I had this amazing dream. I dreamt I was everywhere and part of everyone." Right? And it felt so amazing that I didn't want to wake up. Now, of course, if you're spiritual, you learn eventually that when the soul is separated from the body, you're no longer bound by space-time, basically. And so you have the ability to be everywhere. And if all of our souls come from the same source, if you want, then by returning to the source, you're part of everyone. You're connected to every other soul. So I learned that 5 years later. At the time, all I heard was my son giving me a quota, which was so weird. Because then all I heard in my head is Ali telling me, "Make me everywhere and part of everyone." And at the time, I was a year out of Google into Google X. So I had, worked on the 4 billion strategy.
Having delved into the profound connection between dreams and the essence of the soul, the conversation now shifts to the intriguing ways our minds conjure up scenarios, particularly when faced with the uncertainties of life and financial freedom.
Right? Okay. You're going to starve to death. And I'm like, how can you prove that, brain? Right? And then my brain starts to come up with scenarios where, what if, your car breaks and you need to fix it? Easy, right? What if this happens? Easy, whatever. Until I remember vividly that my brain then said, what if the US attacks Iran? And then that escalates to a nuclear war. And then all of your real estate assets in Dubai get wiped out, right? How will you survive then? And then I found myself laughing out loud saying, well, in that case, I don't think your money is the biggest of your concerns, right? But isn't that how our brains constantly,
right,
try to fool us, right? And then I remembered something I read when I was very young about financial freedom, right? And financial freedom, interestingly, is never about income. So most people, wealth is about income, right? And wealth does not make you financially free, because if you make $1 million a year, but you want to change your Ferrari and go on a first class cruise every year, right? You're still poor, right? As a matter of fact,
right.
One of the biggest problems that our world today is that so many citizens and nations, including the world's largest nation, is in so much debt. Why? Because they're spending.
Of course. I always, yeah.
Yeah.
I always laugh that we have here in Silicon Valley tons of broke millionaires. I mean,
broke
they're literally millionaires, yeah. But they feel broke all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And the idea is, you look at me. I after I found my path to happiness with Ali's help, 20 years earlier, suddenly I didn't need an Armani suit anymore, and I didn't need a fancy car. I still love fixing them and selling them, as I said, but I don't need it in my life. And so my entire expense is just, nothing really. Okay. My daughter's an adult, my ex-wife is completely fine, taken care of. Myself and my loved ones are okay. And so when you really think about it, most of your financial freedom happens on your spending side, not your income side. And I think that was really what got things clear in my mind, because living as the chief business officer of Google X requires you to pay some expenses that may look like things are highly inflated, right? But when you really sit down and look at your actual expenses, if you don't have to spend on your work, on the image, on the networking, on the travel, on, you know, if you just take all of those expenses that are actually expenses to get in the revenue, right? If you take all of those out and you simplify what you actually need, you'll be fine, right? More interestingly, the other reason is that most people will say, but what if things go wrong? And I think I got first class MBA degree from life in when things go wrong.
Of things that can go wrong.
Because I'll tell you openly, I planned everything for Ali. I had insurance policies on my life in his name. I had, properties and real estate in his name. I had started businesses. So Ali changed majors 3 times. I would start a business in his major so that when he comes out, he graduates, he runs it, right? And then he dies. So seriously, most of us think that we have to overplan because life is not safe, right? I think you have to underplan because life is not safe, right? You really have to expect the best, because otherwise, if the worst happens, it doesn't matter if you're a millionaire or a billionaire or a trillionaire, right? If something serious, I mean, I didn't know Steve Jobs myself, but I knew lots of people who knew him personally, and they'll all tell you the story of how in his last years, he sort of finally understood that, you know, all of that, and I couldn't prevent this, right? All of the success, all of the money, all of the power, all of the influence. And he really saw it at the end, and he started to say some very wise things on his deathbed, and I think that's the idea. The idea is that, you know, is that instead of you worrying about life to the point that you constantly attempt to aggregate more and more to work against life, maybe the only sure thing you have is that you're alive today and healthy today. Right. And so maybe instead of wasting today to aggregate so that you're safe tomorrow, why don't you live today? Who knows what will happen tomorrow?
No, that's incredible, because I think that's so, so, so important. And I think you talked a little bit about stress. And I think you have an Stressable, which is Unstressable, which is an incredible book. But today, there's just so much stress. And I think you also saw it with your father as well, right? You saw it with your father. You saw it with, let's talk about stress just for a second.
You see, once again, I wrote Unstressable because Alice, my co-author, said we should write it, right? And Alice is, she went to stress school. Like she really, really struggled in her early 20s, you know, everything. Like she lost her sister to cancer, then her father to cancer, and then to an ulcer. And then before that, they lost all of their wealth and money, and, you know, they had to sell their home. She lost her job because her company relocated. Her boyfriend drops her, at the same time. It's like, it's really weird. And you see Alice today, freaking angel. Like, she's so calm, so steady. And so I was basically, you know, in my typical Silicon Valley mindset, I was like, okay, show me a pilot, like write a few pages and let's see. At the same time, I went out and said, what do I know about stress? I actually don't, you know, it's not something that I experience enough, at least mentally. I have reasonable command over my brain. And so anyway, she comes back and writes this beautiful thing. And I always joke that between my writing and Alice's writing, mine has normally bolded letters and equations and bullet points. And then when I read Alice's work, almost every time when I was editing it, I'd go like, you know, I read and read and I'm like, where the F is she going with this? Like, I have no idea why doesn't she just write it in one line? And then suddenly I feel something in my heart, right? So she writes so much in the feminine and I write so much in the masculine. And the book is such a beautiful yin and yang of the topic. And I really, really
love it. It's very mixed. Like you have the equations and you have the personal stories. It's really interesting.
It really is probably one of my favorite books because of that mix that is so also it taught me so much. Anyway, so my view of stress, then, you know, I read her work. I really love how she hits my heart every time. And I go like, look, so let's do this. Here's the structure. Right. And here is what I found out. And basically, Alice in her feminine, I sit down and I go like, you know what really explains stress? And she goes like, what? And I go like, stress in physics. Don't you understand? You know, when you stress an object and I start and she goes like, seriously? And I'm like, yeah, just listen. Right. When you stress an object, you apply a force to it. The force is not the stress. The stress is the force divided by the cross area of the object. Right? So it's not just the external pressures on the object, it's the resources that the object has to carry that pressure. That is how stress is felt. And in humans, right, all of the external events, external stressors, and by the way, most stressors are internal, and we can come back to that in a minute. They're applied to you, but they're divided by your skills, your abilities, your contacts, your resources. Right. Cool. And the more of those that you have, the less stressed you will feel, right? The pressure will be there and it will accelerate across your life, but you'll start to feel less stressed by it. And, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand this because, you know, stuff that freaked me out when I was 20, I managed to deal with in my 30s, right?
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.